Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. One morning in July 1974, Anita Andrews, the owner and bartender at Fagiani's Cocktail Lounge in Napa, California, was found dead in her bar, raped, beaten, and stabbed to death in a bloody frenzy. She'd last been seen alive the night before talking to a drifter who sat at the end of the bar, playing cards and flirting with her. But the stranger, along with Anita's Cadillac, had disappeared. Unable to locate a suspect, police investigators sadly watched a case grow cold over the years. Meanwhile, a month after Anita's murder, young Michelle Wallace was driving down a road in the mountains near Crested Butte, Colorado, when she gave two stranded motorists, Chuck Matthews and a man named Roy, a ride. Dropping Matthews off at a bar, she agreed to take Roy to his truck. She was never seen alive again, nor could a massive search of the mountains locate her remains. The trail leading to her killer also ran into dead ends. 14 years later, Charlotte Sowerwin, engaged to be married, met a smooth-talking man at a laundromat in Livingston Parish, Louisiana. The next evening, her body was found in the woods. She had been raped, tortured, and her throat slashed. The police suspected her fiancé, Vince Lejeune, though he proclaimed his innocence to anyone who would listen. Meanwhile, the man from the laundromat couldn't be located. The three murders would remain unsolved, eating at the hearts, minds, and lives of the women's families, friends, and communities. Then in the early 1990s, a rookie Gunnison County Sheriff's investigator named Kathy Young began looking into the Wallace case and identified a suspect named Roy Melanson, a serial rapist from Texas. Smooth Talker is the story of Melanson, his depredations, and the intrepid police work that went into bringing him to justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Smooth Talker, with my special guest, journalist and author and publisher, Steve Jackson. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Steve Jackson.
Thanks, Dan. It's always a pleasure to be on this show.
It's always our pleasure and my pleasure, so thank you very much, Steve. I won't ask the question how you came to write this, because that would give a little bit too much away, and the audience will know what I mean a little bit later on. So let's just get right to July 1974. Tell us a little bit about Napa Valley, California, and hopefully I didn't mispronounce in the introduction, Fagiani's cocktail bar, Muriel and Anita, and the bar has been in the family. Tell us a little bit about Napa Valley, California, and the bar that Anita and Muriel own. It's been in the family for a while. Tell us, set the stage, please.
Sure. Back then, anybody who's familiar with the Napa Valley now knows it's quite built up, and it's a wine tourist sort of destination, very touristy, lots and lots of people. But back in 1974, it sort of still vineyards are going. All the famous ones are American vineyards are starting to go there, but it's still a pretty quiet town and county, lots of farms, rolling hills, not a lot of strangers, you know, it's sort of everybody knows everybody, though, you know, there's always a few drifters. But anyway, Fagiani's, or Fagiani's, I've heard it pronounced a couple of different ways, is a bar in downtown Napa at this time in 1974. It was founded by an Italian immigrant named Nick Fagiani, who came over originally to work in the vineyards, but bought this place and started his sort of a family bar lounge, you know, kind of a working man's bar. pretty much raised his two daughters there, Muriel and Anita. And, you know, for a while there, it was quite, like I said, working man, bring your family in, hey, your kids can run around the pool table, that sort of thing. The dogs are walking in and out, pretty laid-back place in that sort of a setting. And the girls, two girls grew up there. And, but by 1974, this part of Napa was really pretty run down. It was kind of a lot of seedy bars and a couple of seedy hotels. The hotel right across the street from Fajani's Cocktail Lounge was sort of a stepping stone out of the local psychiatric hospital. And, you know, so it wasn't the nicest part of town. But about 5 years earlier, in 1969, Nick Fagiani had died and left the bar to his daughters. They were trying to sell it, would have liked to have sold it, but they kept it open, and they only kept it open because otherwise they would have lost the liquor license, which was about the only thing it had going for it. So that's the scene. Anita Andrews, the younger of the two, former county beauty queen. She's now 51 in 1974. She does most of the bartending at night. There's never a ton of people in there. There's always, you know, on this particular night, there's three locals who are in there kind of carousing around town. They're workmen, and there's a guy kind of sitting at the end of the bar flirting with Anita, kind of flipping some cards around, and doing those sorts of things. But not a whole lot of other people. A couple people drift in and out.
Now, one of these gentlemen is David Luce, and he's gone to the washroom, and his buddies, like you say, they're out carousing. And describe this altercation and why this altercation occurs and what David Luce does in this
event. Like I said, the three guys, workmen, construction workers, including David Luce, is one of them. They've had a couple of beers already. They're kind of doing a bar crawl around town and are headed for yet another bar from here, just kind of stop by for a couple of beers. But this guy on the other end of the bar, they can tell he's purposefully kind of trying to shield. He has his back to them, and when they kind of try to get a look at him, he shields his face from them. And he just sits funny. He just kind of strikes them wrong some ways. And they're a little bit protective. Everybody in this town is of Anita Andrews. And one of the guys, as David goes off to the bathroom, one of his friends decides he doesn't like this guy's attitude and actually starts yelling at him in the bar, saying, you know, hey, what's the matter with you? What are you trying to hide there? He seemed to have pegged it, but David comes out of the bathroom and hears his friend yelling at this guy, so he's kind of like, well, let's leave and move on to the next bar. And Anita, wants these guys out. They've had too much to drink, doesn't want to fight there at the bar. I don't think she sees anything wrong with this guy sitting at the bar he's going to finish his drink and have his cigarette. Move along himself, but she doesn't want any fights, of course, so she kind of hustles the three guys out of the bar, and as they're leaving, David Luce goes up to the guy and shakes his hand, and basically he's playing peacemaker. He says, you know, we didn't mean anything by it, and have a good night, mister. And this guy doesn't say much of anything, but the three carousers leave the bar, and the last ones in the bar are Anita and this guy sitting at the bar.
Now, what you also set the stage too is that there's not only are other people in the little community of 34,000, 50 miles north of San Francisco, kind of protective of Anita and her sister, but also that there's a police nightly patrol by police, and if they were to see the padlock on the door, and they don't see Anita's tan colored Cadillac, then they would be doing further investigation. So it's sort of an unofficial thing that even the police are protective of her. So now we're talking about the next day. Now, Anita works at the Napa State Hospital for the criminally insane. I don't know if that's ironic, but the next day they call her mother, Muriel, and they're looking for her. So take it from there. What happens after that?
Well, they actually call Anita's mother. Muriel is her sister. The mother calls Muriel and says,
right.
You know, your sister didn't show up for work today, which is really unusual. Anita's very punctual, never misses work at the hospital. They really don't really like having the bar open. Neither one of them likes the neighborhood and are kind of scared of the neighborhood. So the mother calls Muriel and says, well, go check on Anita, see what she's doing. Maybe she's sick at home or something. So Muriel gets in her car and she drives over to Anita's apartment and there's no one there and the Cadillac's not there. So she decides, well, I'll go down to the bar, see if she went down there. Maybe she forgot something or whatever and went down there. And so she goes down and she arrives there and she notices that there's no padlock on the front door, but the Cadillac isn't around either. So it's very unusual that, like I said, this is not a nice part of town, and they went to extra efforts to put a big padlock on the doors to protect the place. So that's missing, but yet there's no sign of Anita outside as far as her Cadillac. So Muriel thinks that's curious as she goes toward the bar.
Now, continue with that. What does she do? Does she call anybody to get some help, or does she just venture into this bar herself?
No, she goes into the bar. It's, you know, once again, this is daytime now, and so this is a place that she was practically raised as a kid, so she doesn't really have any trepidation about going into the bar. She thinks it's unusual that it's unlocked, and so she goes in and, notices that the place is pretty clean. Like, her sister was pretty dedicated to the place just being kept spotless. But she does notice that there's an ashtray on the bar still. So she goes, and then she notices that the storeroom doors away from the bar, at the back of the bar, are closed. And that's unusual because they typically left them open and didn't go through the effort of closing those. So she went back there still thinking this is curious. I'm sure she called out for her sister, but there's no answer. So she walked back to the storeroom and gets to the storeroom, and it looks like just a savage attack of some sort. There's blood on the wall. There's blood on boxes. There's blood coming down off of stacks of beer bottles, and they're laying on the floor, partly undressed, is her sister, Anita, who's been murdered.
Okay, so police arrive. They got to gather some evidence. So let's tell our audience what they do find in terms of evidence, what's missing, and just tell us what they find at this crime scene and the condition of Anita as well. What has happened to her?
Well, they come in. This is the days before a lot of like crime scene investigators, but they do have the Napa Police Department can't afford a criminologist of its own, so they had a guy over in Berkeley near San Francisco who was actually associated with the University of Cal Berkeley there, and they call him over to look at this crime scene. You know, they just don't have these sorts of things. You know, the kind of murder you'd have in Napa would be somebody getting mad at somebody else at a bar or something like that, but just this savage attack on a woman who never hurt anybody or anything else. So they called in the criminologist, and he went through that, and he, for that age, was an amazing criminalist, crime scene investigator. I mean, he went over that place, picked up there's the ashtray that was on the bar. There was a single cigarette butt in it, and he took that. He took photographs. One of the interesting things that he noticed right away was that all the bar stools along the bar, under the bar, had been very neatly lined up, almost, you know, sort of to line them up like that, you really want your chairs in a row. But the very last one, the one over by the ashtray, was still pulled out from the bar, as if Anita had not gotten around to putting it in its proper order or taking the ashtray off. So he finds that. He finds a screwdriver in the sink. The sinks are clean, pretty much clean, but though some of the water will later test for some blood. And he finds a screwdriver. It's a little bit bent, a kind of a narrow screwdriver laying next to the sink. It's obviously been washed off because it's even had a chance to leave a small rust spot on the steel sink. And there's a towel laying on the floor, so he gathers all these things. They take some, you know, Anita is taken for an autopsy. They find glass in her hair and a cut to her scalp indicating she'd been struck by a bottle, and this criminalist had picked up shards of that glass and took it with them. They found another number of beer bottles that had been around that day, so they gathered all those up so they could be fingerprinted. But Anita, as far as her condition, she'd been stabbed 13 times with this screwdriver, mostly in the chest, but just she had put up quite a battle. I mean, that room, the photos from that room have blood splattered from one end to the other. It was just, she fought hard, and but whoever was after was just in a furious rage. And he ends up stabbing her 13 times, attempted to sexually assault her. Was not completely clear if he managed to do that, but he certainly disrobed her and tried. And had also strangled and beat her. Her nose was broken. She suffered a number of contusions, bruises, and lacerations in addition to the stab wounds.
There was also, she had no watch, ring, or jewelry. There was no purse found, no credit cards, no car keys, and there was some bloody footprints, wasn't there, left?
Right. There was a bloody footprint leading to the storeroom from the bar, and the stairs that went upstairs to the office where her purse and the cash from the cash box and other things were all missing, along with the jewelry that you noted. And there was one bloody footprint over by the door as the killer left the bar.
Now, I'm going to ask you how police proceed. Usually, of course, police look at the suspect closest to most familiar, the ex-boyfriend, the current boyfriend, the ex-husband, the disgruntled employee, something like that. But we've got to make sure that people understand there were no computers at this time in 1974. So before we talk about what happened a month later in terms of the credit card, let's talk about Detective John Bailey and Robert Jarecki, and how do they proceed? Who do they look at? How does their investigation move forward?
Well, it's one of those good old-fashioned gumshoe detectives where they hit the streets. They start canvassing the neighborhood, looking to see if there's anybody had acted strangely or differently. They actually got a suspect of some guy who had checked into the hospital across the street and then checked in the day before, then checked out that morning, kind of in a hurry. So they're doing that sort of thing. Just, did anybody see anything? Did anybody hear anything? And they're also, they're talking to the ex-husband. They're talking to the daughters. They're talking to friends, and they developed, there was a boyfriend, sort of on again, off again boyfriend who had been. She was done with him supposedly because he'd run up a big telephone bill, and I think he worked for the carnival and was gone a lot. So she told others, including her daughter, that she was sort of done with this guy. But so they're doing that kind of good old fashioned, trying to run down every lead that they can. During that first morning, David Luce, the guy we talked about from the confrontation the night before, had actually heard what happened and came over to the bar and described him and his three friends being there, and that there was a stranger sitting at the end of the bar talking to Anita, and he was the last one left in there. they actually, David Luth and his friends were suspected for a little bit, or at least on the suspect list, because, you know, they're admitting that they may have been the last ones to see Anita, except for this stranger that nobody can see and has heard of or anything else. So they even had to be cleared, but it was quickly apparent that they had gone on to this other restaurants and that sort of thing. So anyway, that is where we're at is they are just, you know, they're looking for old people in the area who have done rapes before, or maybe felons or robbers, because Anita was robbed and maybe she resisted the robbery. So they're running through those sorts of things.
Now tell us about the break that they do get finally, because it does take a little while. It might have been a little bit quicker, but what happens 30 days later in terms of the credit card hit 60 miles northwest of Napa? So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you're right. There's no computers at this time, so they kind of had to wait for, they could eventually get asked for credit card companies to, you know, report any sort of transactions, but those would take, you know, in this case, it took 30 days that on the night of the murder, the tan Cadillac, a man driving a tan Cadillac had pulled into a gas station down in Sacramento, which is about an hour away. He had the attendant on duty there noticed that he had sort of a towel on his lap and it appeared to be bloody, but the attendant for some reason didn't really ask him about it. He noticed that there was a woman's handbag in the back seat of the car, and then when this man driving the Cadillac went to pay for it, the gasoline, he handed him a credit card with Anita Andrews' name on it and said that was his wife, and even signed it A. Andrews before he left, headed south, and which would be, you know, toward San Francisco, toward L.A.
Now, with this information that they have, you know, too little too late, but what does this trail lead to for them? What does it lead to in terms of suspects?
Well, they actually, some years later, they sort of develop a couple of different theories. One is that, you know, this is a stranger who came into town, crime of opportunity, way that those guys left. He attacks Anita, who fought back. He kills her and robs her and takes her Cadillac and disappeared south. And the other theory developed actually more by the district attorney at the time, who happened to also be a friend of Anita's, was that perhaps it was somebody who she knew who had done this and then possibly even taken the car somewhere and gotten rid of it and then had doubled back. So for years, no one quite knew who this killer was. Was he a stranger or was he somebody still living among them?
So I guess the cat's out of the bag. This case goes cold. So what we do jump to right away, and you do in the book, is that in short order, we're talking about August 30th, still 1974, but this is 1,100 miles to the east. So tell us about a little bit about 25-year-old Michelle Wallace. She's an avid outdoors person. Tell us a little bit about her. She's an avid photographer, but tell us a little bit about this 5'6", 120-pound beauty, Michelle Wallace, 25 years old, and we're talking about 1,100 miles away in August.
Michelle's quite an interesting person. Yeah, for her era, 1974, a young woman who, you know, easily went up into the mountains to go backpacking with her dog. I was into photography, was sort of very adventurous. She had was about to go on a photo expedition for National Geographic, I believe, taking photographs of the hill people in the Carolinas, kind of last of that part of that civilization. But was working in the mountains of Colorado, backpacking, sort of a carefree, happy-go-lucky spirit, had lived in Aspen, the ski area, for a while. just sort of a bright light, one of those people that, you know, everybody liked, and marched to her own drummer. And so she's up in the mountains in August 1974.
Now, what is her plans? She is doing this, but what is her ultimate plans? She's going to do this for, she's got this assignment here for a couple months, and then she has this other professional assignment. So, and does anybody worry about this woman? And you said she's an independent type person, but just tell us about what she had really planned, and if there was any concern for her being able to take care of herself.
Well, her plans were, Michelle, I think she wanted to be a professional photographer, and I don't know how much farther ahead she was looking other than the next place. She did it was very close to her family, particularly her mother, who all lived back in a little suburb near Chicago, Riverside, North Riverside, and she, she checked in most every Sunday. In fact, I think she always checked in on Sundays with her mom, would call from wherever she was and check in just to tell them she was good. But her mom also kind of lived through Michelle. Her mom had, father, George, had married young, and I think her mom kind of, you know, lived vicariously a little bit through Michelle's adventures. So she was always encouraging Michelle to get out there. Michelle, after high school, went off to Spain for a while to study and travel, all with the blessing of her mom. So, you know, her dad was a little more concerned about it. He's, you know, a typical dad. It's his daughter out there. But, you know, they also took some pride in Michelle being such an independent spirit and, you know, striking out on her own and living the life that she wanted to live. And she also had a friend, Donna. I don't know if you were referring to Donna, but Donna Campaglia, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right, Donna, if you're listening.
Yeah.
But she's Michelle's sort of her spiritual sister. These two were, their birthdays are only 6 days apart, and they met and kind of looking in the mirror in junior high and putting on the makeup, and it become pretty much during those school years inseparable. And then after high school, of course, they were living their own lives and traveling a bit, and both of them sort of vagabonding a bit, but they always checked in, and they wrote dozens and dozens of letters, and just one of those friendships, you know, that you know you're going to have when you're 90 some odd years old, or you should in a good world.
Now, in late August, she plans a short trip. This is like the 27th. She says she's going to be back by September 2nd. So we're talking just a few days, but she's going to go. She's going to go backpacking, and then tell us about what happens. What's the circumstances where she meets Chuck Matthews and a stranger named Roy?
Well, as you said, she had gone backpacking for a few days in this area, and it's kind of, she was going to come out. This was going to be her last trip. She was pretty much done, and was going to have to move out of away from Gunnison, Colorado, where she was, and go back east and begin this new job. So she's kind of taking one last hurrah in the Colorado mountains, and did that for a number of days with her German Shepherd, Oki. And she was walking out of the from the trailhead down to the road toward her car, where she'd had to park a mile or so away from the trailhead. And these two guys came kind of up past her and stopped and gave her a sip of beer. And they were going up farther, and she was walking down the road. And they kind of came back, and they passed her. And she gets down and gets to her car, and they actually pick her up and they start giving her a ride, and then his car breaks down, so now they're all on foot. So they get to Michelle's car, and they all pile in that, and she's going to take, this is up near Crested Butte, a good 20 some odd miles away, and she's takes herself and them down to Gunnison, where she lets Chuck Matthews kind of an old ranch hand, Vietnam vet guy, a little bit of an alcoholic. She let him off at a bar there, the Columbine Bar in Gunnison. And Roy Melanson says that, asked her if she could drive him a little bit farther and take him to where his truck is.
Now, you said in the book that was strange for Chuck, because tell us why Chuck thought that was very strange when Roy had asked this woman to drive him a few blocks to his truck.
Well, Chuck didn't know Roy very well. They'd met in the bar, the same bar, a couple of days earlier, just having some beers, and then spent the next 2 days out traveling around. Roy said, oh, he was working for a rancher, and there was a troublesome bear that they were going to hunt. But they were mostly wandering around drinking beer and, just carousing up in the mountains there when they come across Michelle. And they were driving Chuck's truck or car, and just like it did when they met Michelle, it kept breaking down and had flats and all sorts of problems. So when Chuck hears that, and Roy had never mentioned that he'd had a vehicle or a truck they could have driven around or something instead of his. So when he hears Roy, and that's, he only knows him by Roy, never asked him his last name apparently, only knows him by Roy. This guy Roy asked the girl if she can drive him to his truck, and he thought that was strange because he'd never heard of a truck, this guy having a truck. But on the other hand, by this time, all Chuck wants to do is get into the bar and have a few drinks. So he, against his better judgment, I guess, lets the girl go off with this guy, Roy, toward his truck.
What's interesting, too, is that Roy says, listen, I'll be back in a little while. And Chuck does not see him that night. And, in fact, you talk about it's very, very different circumstances in the near future that they speak again. We're going to use this as an opportunity, Steve, to stop for a moment to talk about pro flowers. Now, Mom has always been an expert on everything, cooking, relationship advice, fixing your cuts and bruises. In fact, my mother is still the expert I go to for recipe advice, like what are the names of those three cheeses that she puts in her famous lasagna again? But the one thing you can't ask her advice about is what to get her for Mother's Day. But not to worry, you'll look like an expert on Mother's Day when you use Pro Flowers. Now, with this special offer, get Mom 100 blooms with a free glass vase for $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Or make her day extra special, upgrade to a premium vase, and add gourmet chocolates for just $9.99 more. Go to ProFlowers, that's P-R-O, flowers.com today, and use my code TRUEMURDER. ProFlowers takes the guesswork out of sending Mom, Grandma, or your wife the perfect Mother's Day gift. ProFlowers are guaranteed to be fresh and beautiful for at least 7 days or your money back. For my mother's birthday, the folks at ProFlowers created a beautiful arrangement with a very nice matching vase. The roses and lilies were vibrant and super fresh, and they lasted for many days after the week that they had promised. Now, my mother's best friend and neighbor was so impressed with ProFlowers, she immediately ordered some flowers and chocolates for herself. Now, here's the only way to get 100 blooms with a free glass vase starting at only $19.99. Visit proflowers.com, it's one word, click the blue microphone in the top right corner and type in True Murder, one word. That's ProFlowers, ProFlowers.com. Click on the microphone and type in True Murder. Remember, Mother's Day is next week. And order today because this offer expires Friday at midnight. That's ProFlowers.com. Okay, Steve, when we last left off, we have Chuck Matthews thinks something was strange when his friend Roy, who hadn't mentioned the truck whatsoever, says he's going to get a ride and he'll be back, and he doesn't visit, he doesn't see his friend again, doesn't think anything of it. What happens with this woman and the search for this missing woman? Tell us about that.
Well, Michelle disappears. Chuck is the last person to see her alive anyway. And what happens is that, but nobody really notices. Her roommate is out of town at a wedding for some other other things, and nobody really knows that she's missing until she doesn't make her weekly call home to her mother, Maggie. And Maggie, of course, is alarmed just because Michelle was so regular about this and knew that her mom kind of waited for her calls. But Maggie calls Donna, and Donna, you know, she thinks this is unusual too. But then again, you know, Michelle's 25 years old. She might have found some people she was having fun with up in the mountains and decided to stay an extra day or so, and or maybe get a new boyfriend or something like this. But these are the days before cell phones, so it's a little harder to call home. And so she wasn't completely alarmed. You know, she believed in her friend's abilities to take care of herself. She knew she was quite the outdoors woman. She was a rock climber and done all sorts of things. So she wasn't terribly alarmed at first, but her mother was. And a day later, her mom called the sheriff's office and still hadn't heard from her daughter. And now the sheriff's office decides, well, okay, you know, kind of at her insistence, they send an officer, a lieutenant, actually a sub-lieutenant, to her apartment, Michelle's apartment, just to see if, you know, he can find her and say, hey, call your mom or whatever, or find out something. Gets there, and Michelle's roommate has returned, but she says, you know, Michelle hasn't, and she's a little concerned about it too, because she knew that Michelle needed to work and was supposed to pack up her things and be getting ready to move on, and she hadn't heard from her either. So now people are starting to worry, and this continues for several days until a massive search is launched for her. Once again, this is Gunnison, Colorado, is a very in a very rugged area of Colorado, lots of mountains and valleys and rivers and all sorts of places that a backpacker, especially one alone, could have fallen, been injured, or any one of a number of different things, and be looking for some help. So a massive search is launched.
Now, what kind of results do they net from this search for these amount of days? And what happens? Do they find her car?
No, at first they don't find her car has disappeared, which is unusual. It was a red car. And they were doing air searches and everything else, and they couldn't find it. So this goes on for a little bit. And then finally, one day, Chuck Matthews, our guy who was hanging around with Roy, he hears on the radio that they're looking for a girl with a German Shepherd who was supposed to be backpacking in the area that he had been. And he realizes this fits the description of the girl who gave him and Roy a ride back to Gunnison. And so he contacts the police. And so now the police are worried that she actually did come out of the hills. They know that. So she's not in the hills anymore, according to this guy, Chuck. But she disappeared in the company of a man that nobody knows named Roy Melanson. And this is followed up with a report shortly after that a rancher calls up and said he shot a German Shepherd dog matching the description of the dog last seen with Michelle. And it does turn out to be Oki. The dog was running loose and chasing cattle. And so the you know, as ranchers will do sometimes if something's bothering their livestock, he actually shot the dog. So now they know things are, something's really wrong. Michelle came out, she's disappeared from with the company of some man nobody knows. Her dog is running around loose. She was very attached to the dog. That would have never happened. They can't find her car. So things are pretty desperate at this point.
Now, they have one lead in terms of Chuck Matthews says that Roy had said he'd worked for a sheep rancher. So they were looking for a sheep rancher in Schofield Park. What were their efforts there? Did they net any results?
Well, they did, and they found the rancher who had hired Roy Melanson to watch, to hunt some coyotes and that sort of thing. Roy, as the book is named, Smooth Talker. Roy was a real smooth talker, and he had talked his way into having a job, supposedly hunting coyotes that were bothering the sheep rancher's herds. No real proof that he ever accomplished much of anything, but that's just who he was. So they did find this rancher, and the rancher, he had hired a guy named Roy. In fact, he knew his name was Roy Melanson, M-E-L-A-N-S-O-N, and said that, you know, the guy didn't have much of anything, certainly didn't have a vehicle, didn't have, had to be loaned a sleeping bag, for that matter, to be able to work. But he had fired him because he wasn't getting his work done and was hanging out with his family, sort of a hippie family in the hills there. So, and hadn't seen him in several days.
Now, Roy Mullinson's, as you describe in the book, he's 6'1", 190 pounds, thinning hair, and you say remarkably large hands. He's born on February 13th, 1976. 37 in Brobridge, Louisiana. And you said he was well known to law enforcement in southern Texas and Louisiana even before he was 20 years old. Tell us what kind of crimes he was first convicted of and known for in Texas.
Well, he kind of starts early. He's still a minor when he gets his first burglary raps and breaking and entering and does these sorts of things. Eventually gets a little bit older and serves some time in prison. Then when he gets out, he kind of ups the ante a little bit by trying to rape his cousin, a female cousin. And he's actually convicted of this, but he takes off and doesn't serve much of any time. He just kind of disappears. And he commits several rapes down in Texas. One, the victim testifies against him at an arraignment and he skips bail and goes and lives in a different part of the state and finally gets caught again when he, this is 1974, February or so, I believe, of 1974, where he rapes yet another woman, and this time he takes her and drives her back and forth for a few days from Texas to Louisiana, raping her, threatening her, rope around her neck, and if she ever struggled, he would tighten the garrots and choke her, and just sort of a brutal few days of this young woman. She was only 17 at the time. I had to endure with him. But at the end, she talks him into convincing him that maybe they could be an item. He shows her his driver's license and then admits he'd kind of stalked her around the high school and this sort of thing. So when she finally talks him into letting her go, she goes to the police and he's arrested. And this time, they have him in jail for when again he's going to skip town.
The sort of the seems the situation constantly is he gets a fairly stiff sentence, but through parole and through various other things, various other circumstances, he seems to get out in a fairly short period of time. And that continues, even though he has these very serious sexual assault charges, doesn't he?
Yes, and in fact, in 1974, he skips bail again. It's part of his, there's a couple of interesting things here. One is the, you know, where the name of the book comes from, the smooth talker, that he talks these women into, oh, he's going to help them get gas when they run out of gas, or he's going to change a tire for them, or he does all
right.
These sorts of things. And he's kind of a smooth talker no matter where he goes. So he doesn't spend, he goes to prison and doesn't, you know, he gets 12 years, serves six. He a couple of times he gets bail and he takes off on bail even though he's done it before. So in 1974, he actually skips town and takes off with some say his wife, some say just a girlfriend, but a woman he got pregnant and takes off for Arizona while he's out for this 1974 rape, the one where he was taking the young woman back and forth across the border. And so it really is that, you know, law enforcement sort of fell down on the job here about putting this guy away when he's obviously a serial rapist at the very least, and he's escalating. Things are getting more violent. He's threatening to kill him. He's got a gun. He's getting worse.
Tell us about Sally Burton, just to further cement the MO and signature of this Roy Melanson.
Well, Sally Burton is a, I told you about, he was the sheep rancher said he's living with a family there, and there's the Burton family. They're kind of up at this family cabin up in the hills. And the mom and her five daughters are all there, and the dad is, they're from Pueblo, and he's back working down in Pueblo. But Roy is his way into the good graces of the Burton family, at least mom at first, and then he takes a particular shining to Sally, who's 14 years old, I can't imagine doing this as a father of daughters myself, but she allows Melanson to talk her into, when they have to go back to Pueblo to join her husband after their vacation, she tells Melanson, sure, her 14-year-old daughter can stay behind with him and, come down later when Melanson decides to return her to Pueblo. So they leave Sally with him, and they have a sexual relationship going on where she's pretty much kept a prisoner in the cabin. This is a little bit different. He's using his charms and that sort of thing on her. I mean, she knows that she has no, she better not try to get out or leave the cabin, and she better do what he wants when he asks for sex. But this isn't the brutal raping and threats to kill that some of these others were. He's quite a chameleon when he's, he can be perfectly charming in a situation, even though, of course, this is a sexual relationship with a 14-year-old.
Now tell us about Melanson and Michelle Wallace, how they meet, and tell us a little bit about their meeting.
Well, Roy had, as we said, Roy gets picked up by Michelle and with Chuck, and then he leaves with Michelle. And then Michelle isn't heard of. Now, once we get the sheep rancher and Chuck Matthews and these guys, they now know they're looking for a guy named Roy Melanson. Could be driving a red Mazda station wagon, which was Michelle's car. And so they're looking for this guy, and so they have a bolo out for him. And in the meantime, Roy has taken off in Michelle's station wagon. He's cashed some checks. He now takes her. He goes down to Pueblo to see Sally Burton. And the Burton stays down there for a little bit. He actually has Michelle's camera. Somebody takes a photograph of him laying on the couch there at the Burton home with a young visitor, not one of the Burton girls, but a visitor from a different town, sitting in front of him. It's kind of a very creepy photo, and it's the very last photograph taken on the film that Michelle had in the camera. So, but he later, he takes that camera and he hawks it, pawns it actually, and pawns her camping equipment and drives her car all over the place. He drives it 1,000 miles down to Texas, out to Oklahoma. And he finally meets this other guy, and they kind of become drinking buddies, and he ditches the Subaru down in Texas and drives back up to Pueblo, and he's kind of hanging around the school looking for Sally Burton to get out of school with this other guy, and when he gets pulled over by the police because somebody reports sort of two creepy middle-aged guys hanging around the school looking at the girls. So he gets pulled over, but the police computer, such as it is at this time, is down. So at first nothing happens, but then shortly afterwards the computer goes back up, and the police officer who had pulled Melanson over and seen his driver's license now learns that Melanson is wanted for both a rape in Texas and he's wanted in Gunnison, Colorado. And so he goes back. They eventually find Melanson. There's an all-point bulletin, and there's a manhunt for him in Pueblo, and they eventually catch him at a motel.
Well, how does tell us how this Thurman Gene Wilder fits in this as well? Because he spends again is incredible. You say he's a born bullshitter, but he talks to a guy that he meets in a bar, and the next thing you know, he's convincing him of his way out of a white Cadillac. So tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is the guy he meets when he's driving the Subaru around, and they become drinking buddies. He tells Wilder that Wilder's a heavy construction equipment driver. So Melanson says, follow me out to Pueblo. I got a friend up there who can give you a job right away. So that's basically why Wilder is with him, other than, Melanson is a good talker and I guess good to drink with and that sort of stuff. So, we're not talking about a couple of rocket scientists here. So we have Wilder and Melanson, and they're, Melanson gets him to come up to Pueblo, which was Melanson's only real motive there, was to ditch the Subaru a long ways away down in Texas and then return to Pueblo to find Sally Burton.
Now, once these guys are arrested, you say they find the pawn tickets, one for the sleeping bag and a backpack, and then the one for the 35mm camera. They find an unused bus ticket from Gunnison to Pueblo and a set of Mazda car keys. So how do police proceed with this information now?
Well, they actually developed the film. Melanson is arrested, and he's taken up to Gunnison. He's wanted now for questioning in the Michelle case, but he's also, there's a check forging charge against him that gives them the ability to arrest him and take him up there, because they can't charge him with anything in Michelle's case. They don't know what's happened to Michelle at this point. But they do manage to take him back to Gunnison on a check charge. So they've got him in custody. Now they're trying to figure out what to do. So they run some of these pawns down. They pawn the camera, I believe, in Iowa or Oklahoma. I forget which one it was now. But they developed the film in the camera, and most of it are photographs that Michelle had taken during her trip, herself or her dog, the outdoors, the sorts of things she liked to do. There's a photograph taken of it by somebody of her and the dog standing with some family that we still don't know who they are. But at the very last frame on this roll of film that's developed, there's Melanson laying on the couch with the girl sitting in front of him reading the newspaper. And it's just sort of definitely ties Melanson to Michelle's camera, which, of course, you know, Melanson that was at some points was saying that he never met Michelle, never didn't know her, these sorts of things. Now, of course, besides finding the Subaru and Wilder saying, yeah, he was driving a red Subaru and we went here and there and that sort of thing. Now they can connect Melanson to Michelle. They just don't have what happened to Michelle or her body if she was killed and left somewhere. They don't can't find her. They don't know where she is. They don't really want to prosecute a case in which they can't yet prove murder or with the body. And so Melanson is basically up in Gunnison where he beats the check charge, but he's taken to Texas for the 1974 rape he conducted down there where he is convicted. And now he's sentenced to life without parole for as a multiple offender, a three-time loser. And he gets sentenced, this big supposed sentence that should put him away for good. Unfortunately, it doesn't.
Now, in this interim period of where the case goes cold and technology is developed and other people come into play and other characters, we talked about Kathy Young. Let's also maybe you can tell our audience about what happens to Michelle Wallace's mother, Maggie.
Well, sure. This is it's just the whole Wallace story is just such a huge tragedy. After it became apparent that Michelle wasn't coming home and stayed, you know, there's all this growing stuff, and then they hear that she had disappeared in the company of some guy named Roy, and that they'd arrested him and found her camera with him. Maggie despairs. You know, she kept holding on to hope, you know, maybe Michelle was being kept somewhere or had, you know, been hit on the head, if fallen off a cliff or something, been hit on the head. Her friend Donna Campaglia was the same. They're all trying and hoping to believe that somehow Michelle was still alive, but this kind of, it does it, especially for Maggie, who gives up on Michelle coming home, or and even that they can't even find her body. That's just getting to her. So she gets worse and worse, and mentally, and withdraws. And so one night she is about to go to bed with her husband, and she makes up some tea and gives him, asks him if he wants some. He tries it, but it's kind of bitter, so he decides he doesn't want to drink it and puts it down. But she drinks hers, and they go to bed. And in the morning, George wakes up, and his wife is dead. She'd taken an overdose in her tea and left a message, though, saying, you know, if you when you find my daughter's body, please bury her with me. And you know, this death or disappearance of Michelle Wallace is compounded by the suicide of her mother.
Now, in 1979, you talk of a hiker named Thomas Coles, and he's walking along a logging track off the main road over Kebler Pass. And what we didn't mention is that Michelle Wallace had sort of a telltale long dark hair in two thick braids. And two thick braids had been found. Or tell us about the two thick braids that were found.
Well, the hiker you're talking about, he's walking along it's a logging road, but it's not very used at this time. It's getting sort of overgrown, and he's hiking along where he finds up on the road, which apparently been dragged by a scavenger of some sort, a human scalp with dark hair with two thick braids. which he is, you know, he recognizes as seeming to be human. So he takes it down to the sheriff's office, and it's then confirmed to be human hair for sure. But they can't yet prove that it's Michelle's hair because they don't have anything to compare it yet.
And we got to mention too that we're also talking about 1979, so we're many, many years away from any kind of DNA discovery or announcement or development at all.
Right. Yeah, you know, so, it's still a gleam in the scientist's eye, I guess. To say it one way.
So let's talk about a real central figure in this, and that's the young police officer, Kathy Young. So tell us about her.
Well, Kathy Young, she had she was the youngest detective on the sheriff's office. She'd come up to Gunnison area about a year after Michelle, was also a young woman, kind of out for adventures. And you know, this is that time in American culture and history where women were starting to assert themselves as being able to do anything men could do, and Kathy was another one, and she eventually worked her way into law enforcement and became a deputy, and then became the investigator, the youngest one on the Gunnison County Sheriff's Department. She was basically the police officer or the chief up in Crested Butte, which is the ski area fairly near Gunnison, in the area where Michelle had been hiking, says, you know, there's an old cold case that you might be interested in sometime about this girl, Michelle Wallace, who was 25 when she disappeared here in 74. And Kathy goes and starts looking into it. There's another deputy, Scott Jackson, who was involved in the search for, after the hair was found on the road, they again mounted a large search and tried to search this whole area to see if they could find her bones or body, so again that they could try to go forward with some sort of case against Melanson, who at this time, as we know, is serving time in Texas for rape. And so Kathy and Scott, he shows her the evidence box, and she sees the hair, and which kind of sets her back a little bit, makes it very real. But they also, and Kathy sort of identified with Michelle, you know, here's another young woman, same approximate ages, very close, same sort of, wanting to get out there and be adventurous and love of the mountains in Colorado. So, she comes along and looks at this box, and what another part of the box that they didn't notice is that early on in the investigation, within the first few days, that officer who went over to Michelle's house and met a roommate asked for anything that Michelle might have used that, but only Michelle used. And it so happened that the roommate had given her a hairbrush, or given this officer a hairbrush. And so Kathy sees that in the thing, and now they have this hair from the found on the road. So they send the hair from the hairbrush along with the hair on the road to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and it's confirmed that Michelle's hair from the hairbrush and the hair found on the road are Michelle's, are identical. They're both Michelle. So we now have more proof that Michelle is actually dead. But it's still not a case. It's still not enough of a case to go after Melanson. They need to find Michelle. They also, and Kathy also need to build more of a case against Melanson, revisit the old witnesses, try to find Chuck Matthews, trying to find the sheep rancher, re-piece this case together and try to build a case against Melanson.
Where the braid is found, and where the dog was found shot, it's sort of in the same vicinity, within 20 miles or so. So they know, they have a better idea of the area that they might be able to search for. But they also have some information. they don't know how useful it is, but there's a couple inmates that apparently Melanson has bragged to. What the information, a little bit of bits of information, did they get from these two inmates?
Well, these two inmates, Melanson had bragged that he'd raped and killed a girl up in the hill. He tells various stories, one of them that he knocked her teeth out with a hammer or whatever so she can be identified. He'd done this and that. And so he basically confesses to a degree, but he also changes his stories around a little bit. And part of that may be that, you know, he's trying to see who's going to leak information out to the sheriff and who knows what he's doing. He's obviously a sociopath. We know at this point, law enforcement knows at this point that he's at least a serial rapist, and now they believe he's also a murderer.
Now, with you even talk about when he's in prison, he couldn't stay out of trouble. And what is he accused of in prison?
Well, he's accused of killing his – there was a young black man, kind of a small guy in prison, and Melanson was said to have beat him to death, strangled and beat him to death, but nobody would – this is down in Texas, a Texas prison, and nobody was coming forward to – you don't snitch even on something like that, apparently. And so he was. It was believed that he killed this this young man, and he later bragged about it, but doesn't get into any real trouble. And in fact, during this time, supposed life sentence that he was supposed to have received, he gets the repeat offender statute used against him overturned. So instead, they resentenced him to 30 years, but he ends up serving 12 years and instead gets out in 1988. So, and this is during the time when Kathy Young over in Gunnison, Colorado, is working on the case. So these things are kind of happening conjointly, that Melanson gets released out of prison about the same time Kathy starts to really dig into this, the Michelle Wallace case over in Colorado. So we had Melanson at loose in 1988 and Kathy Young working on the Michelle Wallace case in Colorado at the same time.
Now, he's released in 1988, so now we're talking about this 14 years later. Melanson's now 51. He goes to live to Port Arthur. He's staying with the mother of his son that he once abandoned in Tucson and her current boyfriend, and the couple was renting an apartment from Pauline Klump, a 51-year-old woman. So take it from there. What happens with Pauline Klump and Melanson?
Well, Pauline shows up one day, and she's going to pick up a TV from this apartment that she was renting to this couple where Melanson is also staying. And she notes, says something about that she has an air conditioner that needs some help, and Melanson, of course, says, I can repair air conditioners and that sort of stuff. So they leave the apartment complex in Pauline's car, and then the next day Pauline's car is found in a grocery store parking lot, but Pauline is missing. She's never been found, and Melanson disappeared, left town that day.
Now, just terror never and horror story doesn't end. For the victims, there's another person that's sucked into this vortex of murder. Is a person named Vince Lejeune, who has his fiance is Charlotte Sarawin. So tell us what happens with these people, and this is 200 miles east of Port Arthur, Texas. Tell us a little bit about this couple.
Well, they're a young couple. They're 24 years old. They're planning on getting married in about 6 months when Vince turns 25. It's just sort of the date stayed set. But they're a young Louisiana couple from a very small town, Walker, Louisiana, which is in the Livingston Parish. And sort of a one-store town sort of place, but they have their dreams. They have Vince has bought some property outside of town, and they would like to put their dream house up there and raise a family and all these sorts of things. And but they're trying to raise the money to have it cleared. It was a logged area, so there's a lot of stumps there, a lot of brush trees. It just basically needs to be bulldozed and cleared. So he's trying to save up money, but he's a 24-year-old, and he's, you know, every time he saves a dime, he spends a nickel. So there's that sort of thing. So at this time, they're sort of living on her parents' property. There's a shack that's been remodeled. It's not a shack. It's actually the interior is okay, but it's tiny, and it's on her mom and dad's property. So Charlotte is looking to – she really wants to move. She wants to move there. They have a trailer, a travel trailer, that Vince uses in his work as a storage tank repairman. And she wants to move the trailer out to their property and set up out there and start building their home as they can. And so they're doing a little bit of arguing about this because Vince isn't saving money very fast. And so she comes home one day and says, well, I met this guy at the laundromat who says he thinks he can get it cleared cheaper than the guy you're talking to. And Vince is getting a little irritated this time because she keeps bringing this up, and he keeps thinking she's pressuring him, and they're doing that sort of 24-year-old back and forth. So, you know, he finally just says, oh, you know, go ahead. If you think you can get it done, go talk to this guy. So Charlotte says she's going to meet this guy the next day, and they're going to go out to the property, and he's going to give her a bid for clearing the property.
Now, what's the next thing? You talk about that they're having this little argument, and you know, maybe even didn't even say, honey, I love you, because they were having a spat. What happens next? And tell us a little bit about the nightmare that Vince enters into.
Well, he, like you said, they have this spat, and next morning when he leaves for work, he kind of leaves in a little bit of a huff, and you know, he could never, and it bothers him to this day, remember if he told her he loved her or anything like that. I guess those are the sorts of things that we think about many years later. But so he comes home from work, and he kind of wants to kiss and make up and move on from there. But Charlotte's not there when he gets there, and he's, you know, so he's just waiting and tinkering around the house and cooks a couple of steaks up for him, and it's starting to get dark and she's still not there. So he decides to go look for her, and he goes and talks to the parents, who say, oh, we saw her drive off this afternoon. And then he goes and tries to talk to one of her best friends, who said, well, she was talking about meeting this guy at the laundromat who was going to, you know, show her, or go look at the property with her and give her a bid on getting that cleared. And, you know, she's tired of waiting for this to be done, that sort of stuff. And he even talked to one of his buddies who says that he'd seen her talking to some stranger outside the laundromat, and they'd apparently talked something about the property at that point. So Vince decides he better go out to the property and see if she's out there. Wouldn't have been totally unusual for her to go out there. She liked to go out there and sit in her car with the stereo going and listen to music and plan her dream house and that sort of thing. Now, it was a little bit later than she would have normally been out there, so he thinks, well, it's, you know, it's rural property. There's not a lot of people out there, so, you know, what if her battery went dead or something happened or anything along those lines? So he decides to drive out there and gets out to the property. It's out in the sticks quite a ways, and goes down the bend of the dirt road and turns the corner and sees her car just off the road in the weeds. And, you know, drives past, stops his truck, goes back to look, and notices that the stereo has been ripped out of the car. And now he's really worried. He thinks, you know, believes that something's real bad has happened, and even looks in the trunk, but he doesn't touch the rest of the car because he doesn't want the disturb a crime scene, but he's worried that whoever did it might have put Charlotte in the trunk, and so he looks in there, but can't find her there, so he starts walking around calling for her. It's very dark. He didn't have much of anything to look for. He has a flashlight, but it's a large area, so doesn't get far, and he sees a neighbor quite a ways away pull into a driveway, so he hops in his truck and reverses out of there and actually hits Charlotte's car as he's doing that, but manages to turn around and go down to where this neighbor is and gets out and says, "Help me, help me, call the police, please." And the police come out and they do quite a search. This was probably 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock when they're called. And about 2 a.m. in that morning when Vince is there, they're waiting, everybody's out, and they're all searching this wooded area. So it takes 4 or 5 hours before they come back to him and tell him that they found Charlotte. She's been murdered, and so that's when the nightmare really begins.
We won't have time to go into this because this is almost like you've jam-packed so much information into this relatively, not a huge book. But we're not even halfway into this story. Like you say, the nightmare for Vince Lejeune is just beginning. He has no idea.
You're just going to have to read Smooth Talker, Dan.
Yes. Well, we still have a little bit. What I wanted to do was fast forward a little bit to just the role that Kathy Young has in this. And as of 1990, Kathy Young is on the trail of this man. And she doesn't immediately get to the satisfaction that she wants immediately, but she gets on his trail. And so a great part of this book, I guess the upshot of this book, is the fine work that Kathy Young does, the dedication that she has, and then the small, I guess, satisfaction that some of these people have after many, many years of going to court and having Roy Melanson at least get justice served. And it's very interesting, too. We won't get into it, but it's unusual for the behavior of a kind of a killer like this for him not to even attend his own trial. So that's another part of the book that's quite a fascinating aspect of this guy's character. I wanted to say, too, and maybe you can talk about it a bit, that what this book does is successfully tie in another story that you were on this program with, No Stone Unturned, and the fine work of a group called NecroSearch. So just tell us a little bit about, without giving any more away of this story, and then the incredible trial with the display boxes with the black cloth over it and how effective that was. Again, we're just going to have to let the people who have listened to the program so far go and explore the book and find out for themselves. But just tell us a little bit about the incredible tie-in between this story and your other book, No Stone Unturned.
Well, No Stone Unturned is the story of NecroSearch International, which is a group of there's scientists, there's law enforcement, both former and even some current, people with various sorts of expertise, whether it's flying drones or botanists or forensic anthropologists. But they were formed to help law enforcement find the clandestine graves of murder victims, or sometimes not graves, but just remains or even evidence. So law enforcement contacts them. Back when I wrote No Stone Unturned in 2002, they were still sort of a fairly young group, and the law enforcement wasn't always convinced that they could work, but over the years they've really proven themselves, and the Michelle Wallace case was one of their first big ones. This is in NecroSearch International was able to put together a search for Michelle Wallace's remains, partly based on some biological material that was discovered in the hair, along with narrowing some things down, and eventually first found the skull, and then were able to find the rest of Michelle's remains, which showed that the body had been thrown from an embankment above on the road above and come to rest against the tree. This becomes, of course, just a big part of the trial, particularly when her skull is mounted inside of a glass case, a kind of a black material draped over it, and at a moment, and actually this is one of the pretrial motions, but when Melanson is there, and probably one of the reasons why he doesn't attend the trial is they unveil the skull, and he is finally confronted with the results of his evil, and he visibly is shaken by this, and it's as you say, part of the story, but it really was NecroSearch International's first real success story. It had many, many since, but without it, the ability to successfully prosecute this case probably doesn't happen. And if it doesn't happen, then these other cases we've discussed never get solved as well.
It's
and
also
a lot of
incredible
that is-
in the- Go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, we gave credit to NecroSearch International, which is a wonderful organization. I'm proud to be associated with them. But Kathy Young is really the driving force in this. She's simply heroic in how she went after Melanson. And without her dedication and what she did, these other cases also never get solved. And it's quite possible that Roy Melanson would be, well, probable if she doesn't solve the Michelle Wallace case, that he would be out and still attacking women.
Yeah, that's an incredible fact. And everybody was cognizant, especially Kathy Young, of the fact that this guy kept getting out and could be out. And every time he was out, there was evidence of and rumor of and all kinds of talk of all the other murder and rape that this man was committing. He never stopped for a second. What's fascinating about, for those that are going to buy this book and read this book, is that the reemergence of people like David Luce, such a 67 years old, dying of cancer, comes to the trial. Muriel, Anita's sister, of course, Vince Lejeune as well. So all of these people, including the detectives and all the fine people that were instrumental in gathering the evidence, and all the other people that were witnesses with regrets and wanted to have some kind of closure. It had affected their life incredibly, all of these people. It's an amazing trial and result and story about all of the characters involved and all of their reactions to all of the things that go on in this incredible a very dramatic and dynamic trial. I want to thank you very much, Steve, for this. For those that have been listening to the program, we have some Wild Blue Press giveaways again. Maybe you can tell our audience about the prizes that you are going to be giving away, and I'll tell people how they can do that. Just tell us a little bit about what you're giving away this evening.
Well, we're giving away 5 audiobook copies of Smooth Talker, which is the story we've been talking about, and we're going to give 5 ebook copies to your listeners as well. So a total of 10 copies. And the only thing we'd ask is that if you'd care to take a few moments and review these for us. It's always good for the author. It's good for whether it's me or one of our other fine authors at Wild Blue Press. But anyway, it's follow Dan's instructions, and we'll give these. He'll give these away to his listeners.
Yes, I wanted to stress that as well too. Is that I had mentioned that not, I was remiss in not mentioning that too. Except to a couple of the people, the winners, that those that do win and do enjoy the book and do enjoy the program, one of the greatest things for authors is to have a real honest and review from somebody that loved the audiobook or the ebook or the paperback version of the book. That's very, very important for other people, and it's really what other people do to sometimes make their decision is the careful description and the reaction that they have to the book itself. So I want to thank you very much for Steve for those gifts. And for those people that are going to call in, it's the first 10 people that contact me at dan.zupansky, ZUPANSKY.com. But this time for this contest, I would like people, the first 10 people, to say, "Hello, Dan." And that's part of the way you're going to get that prize. So the first 10 people that email personally to dan.zupansky at gmail.com, that's dan.zupansky at gmail.com, "Hello, Dan." And those 10 people will be the winners of the 10 audiobooks that were given to us by Wild Blue Press, Steve Jackson. Thank you very much for those gifts, Steve. And thank you very much for this interview and coming on and talking about this great book, Smooth Talker. Thank you very much, Steve.
Like I said, it's always a great pleasure, Dan.
Well, thank you very much. And be sure that we'll be hearing from you in the near future. For those that might want to contact you or get more information, maybe you can give us, if you do Facebook or Twitter, or give us the Wild Blue Press contact information.
Well, I'm certainly on Facebook as Steve Jackson, and also through wildbluepress.com. That's wildbluepress, all one word, .com, where you can find my books. You can find, we have another 14 authors these days producing some great true crime thrillers, even a few romances and mysteries and that sort of thing too. But www.wildbluepress.com, and you can find myself or any of our other authors.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. You have a great evening, and talk to you again in the future. Good night.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.